right, well, I'll go ahead and get started. Today we are joined by a very special guest, Dr. Fabulous, one of Pepperdine's favorite international studies professors, and that is widely known. Mm-hmm. So we are so excited to have her on today to talk about her new book that's coming out centered on international organizations. But first, we wanted to start off with just a couple of general questions to get to know her a little bit and her story and how she ended up at Pepperdine.
So thank you so much again for being here. We're really excited to have you. So just tell us a little bit about your background and your area of interest and what you kind of specialize in.
Well, hi, everybody. Thank you for that super gracious introduction. I'm Felicity Fabulous. I have been at Pepperdine almost 7 years now, and I think as I was walking up to the recording studio is the very reason why I'm here. Well, there's lots of reasons, but it is an amazing campus and an amazing place to be. I got my PhD at the University of Chicago, and I stayed there for a couple of years afterward as a postdoctoral lecturer, but my family moved out here in 2017. What other background can I share with you?
Just why did you choose to go into international studies or just look into exit from IOs or everything like that?
Sure. I can tell you a little bit about why I study international politics. My undergraduate degree was actually a bachelor's of science in business administration. So my interest when I was one of you guys was something completely different, and I really enjoyed it, and I went and worked for a consulting company for 5 years after undergrad. But I realized that all the big burning questions I had in life, the people that I was surrounded with on a day-to-day basis at my job were not interested in the same things. You know, I was reading The Economist at my lunch break. Nobody else was. I was an NPR junkie, and I wanted to talk about all the things that were happening in the world. And so consulting sometimes has a short lifespan. You know, you work really long hours, drink from the fire hose, learn a lot, but I realized it wasn't what I wanted to do for forever. So I think recognizing that I had this passion for international affairs, my background is very international. I grew up in Australia. I studied abroad in a couple of different places. And so it all kind of came together. I think one of the things I learned when I was consulting is that I loved unpacking problems and trying to come up with answers to really tough questions, you know, where there's not a playbook. And I also really enjoyed presenting to clients. And so that kind of works like research and teaching. So that kind of inspired me to go back.
Yeah, I think that's so funny. I totally relate to what you say about like the nerd alert thing, because even now when I'm driving to school and from school, it's like 20 minutes each way, and I find myself listening to the BBC podcast, just like getting news. It's so funny.
It's what I miss the most during COVID. I don't love the length of my commute and sort of the everyday affair, but I do love that time frame to listen to podcasts and unpack the world and recognize that there's so much going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so good.
Yeah.
I can tell you a little bit more about the topic of the book, but you can keep asking me questions about that because I know we'll get
to it. Yeah, well, I was actually just going to kind of bring that up. So the general topic is international organizations and kind of their exit and the patterns within that. And so kind of more of a general question before we really get into it is, why is your topic important to the global infrastructure and understanding it, or just the global environment as a whole?
Yeah, thanks for asking the question. So the title of the book is called Exit from International Organizations, and I've written it with my co-author, Inken, that I met when I was in graduate school. And one of the things that you first learn when you study international organizations is about all the reasons why countries join international organizations and all the benefits they receive. About 12 years ago, several different countries were suspended from international organizations, and my husband turned to me and said, well, what does that mean? What's going to be the effect of that? And what do all your scholar friends say about that? And, you know, my husband doesn't inspire all of my research questions, but I do think that real world events do, and I realized that because the literature had been so focused on countries joining, that we actually didn't have a whole lot to say about what happens when member countries leave international organizations. And the book actually talks about two different kinds of exit. So first, when countries get suspended, oftentimes for doing things they shouldn't, according to the International Organization Charter, or if they voluntarily withdraw. So really inspired by real world events, but also recognizing that there was a big gap in the literature. And I should throw a plug to my graduate student advisors. They both study international organizations. They're two of the preeminent people in the field. And so it's difficult to take a class from them and not feel the excitement and enthusiasm mm-hmm. and sort of it caught on.
Yeah. So how long have you been working on this book?
I'm not sure this is going to be an inspiring answer. I would say I started collecting data for this a couple of years before I finished my PhD. So I started collecting the data, I think, in 2011.
Okay.
So gosh, we've got a baker's dozen.
Makes it good.
Two reasons, right? I think, A, when you're doing your PhD, you often try to find anything else you can't be working on except your PhD. there's just times when you hit roadblocks and it's really nice to have another project. Second was, you know, these events that were happening in the real world were so exciting and inspiring that I couldn't help but dive in right away. Collecting a data set from scratch also just takes a long time. So mm-hmm. no, I have not been working on it 8 hours a day for the last 13 years, but it has been a mammoth, monumental data collection exercise. And I can talk a little bit more about how I collected the data.
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Well, I know that in the first chapter you said how they kind of like follow a pattern or something along that sort, how like you can see historical examples kind of come through. So do you think that in current day events like that, you can kind of predict it, or is it hard to predict?
I love that you're bringing up history, Lindsay, because this is one of the things I think is really important, a take-home message from the book. When we read the news and when we're inspired by current events, we tend to think that everything that's happening now is the only thing that's important. And one of the take-home messages from the book is that while some exits from international organizations, I think most of us know about Brexit, right? The United Kingdom leaving the EU. Many of us also know about President Trump sort of threatening to leave or actually leaving some different international organizations. So those are contemporary examples. And those are really interesting, I think, because they're big organizations, they're really important countries. But I also wanted to kind of put it in context over time. And so you're absolutely right. One of the patterns that we expose very early on is that actually, exiting international organizations is a phenomenon that has occurred over time, pretty regularly, and it's a strategy that countries use to try to negotiate change. It's not necessarily signaling kind of the collapse of international organizations, but it's really trying to provoke in different ways some sort of change. There's different success strategies or not, but that's one of the historical patterns. I think I answered your question, but you can re-steer me if you got off track along the way.
Well, that's just so interesting. Is it like, I assume that obviously there's countries of different stature in IOs. And so if a big whopping one like China or something tries to leave, it would make a lot more of an impact than a smaller country. Yeah. Do smaller countries still try and make change in these IOs, even though they know it probably won't be as successful?
Yeah. So if you're okay with this, I think I'm going to split your question into two. You guys know I love talking about China and geopolitics with the U.S., so I want to actually talk about China a little bit. It's really actually quite fascinating that China has not used this as a strategy to negotiate change, and we have some reasons for that. One is that they don't have as many sort of outside options as other countries like the United States and the West. And so it's not really a credible threat, because even if China wants change in many of these international organizations, they also get a lot of benefit from sticking around kind of the Western allies and being part of that solution. So China is actually not adopting an exit strategy. By and large, what they're doing is they're creating different kinds of institutions, a lot of informal institutions that they kind of can control, but they're doing that in tandem with staying in organizations. So what you're highlighting, Lindsay, is some countries use exit to negotiate change, but it's not a strategy that is open to everybody, nor has been used evenly over time. I think the second part of your question was asking about smaller countries. So smaller countries actually do tend to be the ones that are most likely to be suspended. So one of the things we cover in the book is that suspension can happen for a whole bunch of different reasons, but it actually doesn't happen as often as it could. Like, even if you violate part of the charter, you're probably not going to get kicked out because there's all kinds of hurdles that are in place, voting rules, other institutional constraints. But the smaller countries are the ones that might need that kind of nudge. And so When they democratically backslide, IO member countries use suspension kind of as a reputational naming and shaming mechanism, right? You're out of the club, and small countries are the ones that really want that reputational name from being part of the club. So, and you're right, some small countries will withdraw, but they don't have as many outside options. So I think you're right that it's the hegemonic or stronger powers that really set this phenomenon apart.
And in terms of exit strategies kind of changing things or maybe changing the narrative or countries, you know, using that strategy to do that, have there been any examples that were kind of success stories in that where a country, you know, did pull out of an organization or they were suspended and it did create that sort of institutional change that was kind of aimed in that decision? Or has it just more been kind of like a hope that that was the case?
There have been some success stories, but I think what you're underscoring is it's not always successful. So I think that there's certain conditions under which it is a more successful strategy. So the more successful cases do come from larger, more powerful countries, right? Because they have that ability. And so I think that this is a consistent story in international politics, that power gets you a little bit more than it could if you were a less powerful country. The second time when it's a little bit more of a success story is when they're asking for slightly smaller changes. Maybe that sounds really obvious, but a lot of what countries want nowadays is sort of massive institutional overhaul, and withdrawing doesn't often get that. That has to be negotiated with countries that are sort of in the organization and everybody kind of working toward that. So we do have a standalone paper that looks at the conditions under which reform is successful. And I think some of the examples, maybe the International Labor Organization, the ILO, also UNESCO, the United States pulled out of both of those. And while both were sort of becoming really politicized during the Cold War, there were some important sort of institutional reforms that took place. And we do some process tracing to argue that it was the threat of withdrawal and not being able to kind of keep going without the U.S. that nudged some of those changes.
Yeah.
But you've got to kind of partner this with the idea that you can't use this threat too willy-nilly or it doesn't become credible, right? That you kind of have to hold it in your back pocket as a last-ditch resort. So we talk a lot in the book about how countries will try to use all of these other strategies first, and only when those fail does this kind of kick in as a strategy for change.
And is there one from the book that really stands out to you of kind of the, you know, shining example of like this was a really big case of this happening that kind of drew you to it, or was it just a series of cases that you were kind of looking at
that inspired writing the book?
Yeah, and this phenomenon kind of exit strategy.
I mean, I do think that what sealed the deal and why readers will be interested in it will be kind of looking at a different take on Brexit, but also putting some of the Trump withdrawals in context. One of the other big takeaways from our book is that while all of this was happening, and there's a lot of other things going on in the world, I think that a lot of scholars really freaked out that they were watching what they thought was sort of the start of a domino effect, like, oh my gosh, Brexit's happened. Now Trump's pulling out of, or at least threatening that the United States is going to pull out of these organizations. Is this the end of international institutions as we know it, right? So there's all this pearl clutching and, I mean, I think legitimate worrying about kind of what does this mean for the state of the liberal international order. And we don't necessarily evaluate sort of how the state of the international order, but what we do try to break down is, and break apart is that withdrawal does not necessarily mean the collapse of international organizations, right? That we've seen this happen a lot over time. And one of the most important data points that we talk about is that over 50% of the time countries come back. And a lot of, you know, and so these withdrawals are temporary. They're not kind of an end case. And a lot of the other really important data point, and this is for both withdrawal and suspension, is that a lot of times they end in the threat stage, that they don't actually get implemented. Mm. And so that's how we kind of reason that it's a negotiating strategy rather than a, you know, we're out. This is, you know, everything's collapsing around us.
Yeah.
I think that's such an important point, because I think a lot of people, when they hear about this in the news, kind of hold on to that point of, like, like you said, like, this is going to be the end of, you know, the liberal order as we know it, or, you know, if they pull out, like, that's it, there's no recovering, and, and you know, a lot of media kind of likes to push that narrative a little bit of, like, end of the world, sort of, like, you know, whenever these
decisions... It's all over.
And
I mean, don't get me wrong, I do think that there's a lot of turmoil and challenges in the international order right now, but I don't think that we should be using exit from IOs as like an indicator of collapse, you know what I mean? And one of the other things that I think is really helpful about the book is we really think about membership sort of joining and withdrawing almost as like a life cycle, you know, that you're going to see ebbs and flows and you're going to see small changes, but we can't kind of jump to that conclusion that, you know, one member leaving is the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah.
Right. Well, also, I was thinking, you said before about, like, credible commitments and everything. So if a country decides to leave and just go against being the IO, does it harm them in more areas than just, like, trying to join other IOs?
I love this. So, Lindsay, this is the second part of the book. So, you know, we just talked about the first part of the book is all about when does this happen? Why does this happen? How often is this happening? For both suspension and withdrawal, we also have specific chapters on, okay, what are the effects of this? And if you buy the argument that I had before that leaving creates reputational harm, in the case of suspension, the remaining member states are trying to reputationally harm the state that they're suspending, right? So they're saying, hey, this is a diplomatic tool. It's a multilateral diplomatic sanction, right? Like, maybe they've run out of other options, or maybe they're using this kind of in a kitchen sink kind of throw all of the things at the country. And so for a suspended country, they do. We have a whole chapter that unpacks the reputational effects. And the really cool thing about it is we quantify some of those effects. So some of the ways we quantify it are we show that the country's political risk scores go up. So a lot of consulting companies have these scores that say, how risky is it to invest in these countries? And we do some cool econometric techniques to kind of really zero in on the suspension, creating some of these higher risk scores. We also have some really neat case studies that show that countries have to be accredited to the UN every year. If you've been suspended from an international organization, the United Nations sometimes gives you a hard time getting accreditation as a country, right?
Wow.
Like if you've been kicked out. There's also a lot of lobbying efforts that go on when the country gets kicked out. They try really hard to either reframe the debate and sort of say, no, you know, this was a valid coup or whatever. And so them lobbying to get that suspension to be removed shows how reputationally harmful it is. In the case of withdrawal, I know one of the things you're interested in terms of the effects, there's kind of two competing effects, right? There's an effect on the country itself. There's also an effect on the international organization. So the country that's leaving is trying to harm the IO and trying to say,
you need to change.
You need to change, right? Like, if you don't do some things that I want, I'm walking, right? And they try to make it really costly. But you can imagine that there's also some harm on the country that pulls out because of what you said before, credible commitments. They committed to staying in that IO and they committed to working with those other countries. So we do actually see reputational harm for the country that withdraws as well, right? Because other countries worry, right, if they couldn't stick in this agreement, are they also going to pull out of other treaty arrangements?
Right.
That they
can we be allies with them?
Right.
Can
we trust them? You know, when they sign up for an international commitment, do we really believe them? Are they just going to pull out? So they actually suffer some reputational harm too. So it's a little bit of a balancing act.
Wow, that is so interesting. So that's like a big thing. You can't just leave or join whatever you want.
Right,
I think we know this, right? That like treaties aren't something that you willy-nilly, you know, just decide to walk away from.
Right.
And I think that we should feel almost good about this, that there is a cost from withdrawing, even if it's legal, right? Like, even if this is something that international law says you can do, a lot of these charters for international organizations actually lay out the rules for how you do it, right? You have to wait around, you have to wait for a year, you have to submit it to this person. And it's, so it's legal, but you're still backing out of your commitment. Mm-hmm. And I think everything we know from international affairs says that backing out of international commitments should have audience costs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a lot of ways, I mean, that's kind of how the international order even functions on a baseline, you know, like just this understanding that, yes, if we sign up for this, like, we're going to continue with it. And so if that were to fall apart, you know, then that would be, there would be a lot of consequences. So like you said, I like that, you know, you said it's kind of a positive thing that the, there are such, you know, impactful consequences because, you know, it's holding up kind of the rest of, kind of the whole thing.
And it is holding up the whole thing, but it's, I think, it's sometimes a difficult thing for scholars to talk about because sometimes it's hard to measure, right? How do you measure a country's reputation? And how do you measure, like, how other countries feel about, you know, the commitment level of a country? And so it has been something that's sort of been difficult to prove till now. You know, it's easier to prove the benefits of membership through, oh, do you get more trade? Do you get economic growth? Do you get security? Those things we have good sort of empirical measures for. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things we're most excited about is by looking at ways that you can quantify reputation, right, through political risk scores or through UN accreditation or through lobbying efforts. Mm-hmm. I love that we kind of, you know, putting some teeth in something that's sometimes soft and fuzzy, like reputation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of reputation just as a whole, do IOs, when they're suspending a nation, have to have, like, concrete something? Or can they just be like, well, we don't really like what you're doing, so we're going to suspend you? Or does it have to be something that is 100%?
This is a really good question. They try to dance a careful dance for a long time. So they will not suspend very quickly at all. So, and when we're talking about the international organization, really I'm talking about the remaining member states, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of politics, you know. Oftentimes it involves kicking out one of your buddies. And so that doesn't happen, you know, if you're going to take them off. So I guess two parts to your two-part answer is, first, they'll do a lot of negotiating, especially behind closed doors. You know, hey, you're slipping here, you need to toe the line, this is violating the agreement, you're kind of on watch. Or you've done this before, or such and such country did this before, you can't do this before. So there's a lot that happens, you know, a lot of warning signs go up.
Right.
But then even when they suspend, I think it's fairly subjective, right? So even if the charter says you can be suspended for, you know, holding an unfair election, a lot goes into, okay, well, who decided that it was an unfair election? Who decided that that wasn't, you know, something that was appropriate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of subjectivity to it. You know, and watching from the outside, there's a lot of politics. You know, the United States is probably not going to be suspended from an organization.
That's very true.
Right.
Right, because there's just a whole lot of geopolitical challenges for another country that wants to be buddies with the United States. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Yeah. So it's not cut and dry.
Yeah.
That was a
long-winded
answer.
No, but that was good. Yeah. It's very important to know that, I think.
And, you know, given kind of the severity of international organizations' exit, just the whole subject, why do you think it hasn't really been studied or talked about up until this point, up until your book?
I think a couple reasons. One is that we focus a lot on in our first chapter is that there's not sort of a ready-made data set. So when people started studying the effects and the consequences of joining, a couple of scholars put in a ton of effort to create a really great database that sort of lists all the international organizations and lists all the countries and lists all the years. So when we want to analyze it, we kind of all have this ready-made, you know, lots of zeros and ones that we can pump into our econometric models. But that data set was very much focused on who joins, and so it doesn't have who leaves. So not having data at the ready is often a, you know, creates a stumbling block for scholars. So that's what took a long time. What my co-author and I did, this is nerd alert again, the library has really cool databases. LexisNexis might be one that you're familiar with, or we actually use something called Factiva. What it does is it allows you to go back through all newspapers on record, all back through time, and we would literally sit there and type in individual country names, individual international organizations, and different spins on the word withdraw or suspend or exit. And
wow.
So we were looking for newspaper records where the media had picked this up. And so we put together our own data set on it. So yeah, if you're interested in something that you think has been covered by the media fairly uniformly over time, but you can, where there's a will.
Yeah, talking about ground up.
A central repository, you know, the International Labor Organization may publish some stuff and UNESCO might on their website, but nobody's doing it consistently. So I think that that was a big hurdle. There wasn't data at the ready, and you can, I don't think anybody sort of, it's rare as well, you know, so it happens. I've given you a couple of examples, but I have, you know, sort of around 400 cases of withdrawal since the end of World War II. That's a lot, but it's not
probably
a lot,
not
too.
Much.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
It's not happening in your face so much
right.
that you would maybe obviously think about it unless you're in the weeds like I am.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
I had one specific question
right.
from the book that really stuck out to me. So
okay.
good.
We'll see if I remember.
So you were talking about political backsliding and how that can cause suspension.
Over 50% of the cases.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I like did not think about that at all. And then in the case of South Africa being expelled from the World Health Organization, does expulsion harm the individual people, especially from something like the World Health Organization? That's something that pretty much everyone uses, obviously, globally. And so is it more of an impact on the individual people in the nation rather than the person in power who's making this decision to, you know, participate in the apartheid and result in the expulsion?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this case up because suspension was a tool that was used, and I think actually quite effectively, to kind of tarnish the reputation of South Africa when they were under apartheid. There was a whole lot of other diplomatic tools that were used, but I do think it was used pretty successfully in this case because other countries were able to kind of come together and actually get agreement. So when we're talking about diplomatic tools of statecraft, right, sort of carrots and sticks, I think that one of the things you always have to think about, and I think that there's a lot of literature on, say, economic sanctions, right?
Mm-hmm.
The goal of economic sanctions oftentimes is to get a regime to do something different, right? The government to do something. But there's these, you know, unintended, quote-unquote, consequences that oftentimes makes it really hard on the people. You're absolutely right that the same thing can happen for a suspension from an international organization. Because, you know, even if you're sort of just kicked out of a trade organization, that means that your country as a whole is probably going to lose access to the international market, which is, you know, oftentimes gets you access to economic growth and things like that.
Right.
And you're absolutely right with the World Health Organization. When a country is suspended, yeah, they're not allowed to attend meetings, and they lose that kind of bully pulpit. They lose those face-to-face meetings. They lose a lot of information. So you're right to worry about, it's not just the government that's being punished, but there's probably ripple through effects to individual people. That'd be a cool spin-off chapter.
Yeah.
4 years.
We'll come back to you later.
And with, you know, like economic sanctions, for example, there's kind of, you know, some alternative solutions to trying to really target, you know, just one people group that are kind of causing the harm versus, you know, affecting the whole population. And is there kind of an equivalent with international organizations, or just inherently it just affects everybody no matter what?
So I'm actually going to answer this by spinning it a little bit differently. I actually think that this is an alternative to economic sanctions, right? Where, you know, we do worry a lot about the sort of ripple through effects of economic sanctions. This is one where the material harms, while I just admitted to Lindsay that I think are there, they're a little bit more minimal. I do think that the real costs here are reputational, and they're reputational on the country and the leaders in particular. So yes, there are spillover effects to individual people, but I think I would make the case that this might be an alternative, you know, diplomatic tool of statecraft that might minimize some of the downsides of something more like economic sanctions.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not as, you know, you know, they don't have as much teeth because mm-hmm. they don't have some of those material effects. But I do think that diplomats think about this as almost like a risk mitigation strategy, or, you know, something to be used in tandem to
right.
sort of increase the blow and make change happen faster sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And we just have one final question. So what advice would you give to someone who's listening, who is interested in these topics and wants to learn either how to get involved or just learn more on the topic?
Okay. Well, I've got all the advice. I think one thing is patience. I've just told you how long it took me to kind of bring together an idea, sift systematically through data. And this is one where I'm not even telling you how much longer still the book has to go. So we turned in the book in June of last year, 2023, to different publishers, and they reviewed it. And we signed a contract with Cambridge in December. We still have the next 6 months to make lots of edits. It'll go in June of 2024, and then we probably will not have it in hand to give you until you graduate in spring of 2025. So publishing really good, solid social science research takes a long time, which can be frustrating, but one of the sort of mantras that has always gotten me through, maybe this is because I'm a long distance runner, is that I have stamina. And so I would encourage anybody that's interested in this work or interested in doing really good research is to have stamina, that, you know, you don't get instant gratification from these sorts of projects, but gosh, after my baker's dozen years, it's really gratifying to kind of talk back through the whole process. Other inspiration. I think I get a lot of inspiration from staying abreast of events that are happening in the real world. And I think you all do too. You're podcasting about these things. And so I think my second piece of advice, and you guys have heard this in class, is to read the news and to listen to podcasts and to take that intrigue about puzzles that are happening in the real world and to try to put them in larger context, right? To ask, is this an isolated instance? Is this part of a pattern? When else has this happened? What nuances these events when they happen in different parts of the world? So those are two pieces of advice. I'll probably have more later, which I'll
No, those are great. Thank you so much. We really appreciated having you. Congratulations on your book almost being out and in hand. And thank you so much for your time.
We really appreciate your time. And if anyone, Pepperdine students listening, go stop by her office and give her a chat. She always has good things to say. So.
Thank you guys. It was wonderful being here today. And I'll be heads down when I'm not in class finishing those final. Thank you.
Thank you.